Now, we have been working on a series that has essentially had a focus in the meaning of womanhood, and it emerges out of the book of Proverbs. That's why we're involved with it now. And the book of Proverbs we're involved with because we have been going through the Old Testament, and we have been surveying the life of Solomon. So this is sort of a climactic passage, although Solomon himself didn't write it, but it's included in his Proverbs. I'm not sure his attitude toward womanhood was all that divine. But anyway, this writing from Proverbs sets the tone of things, and the essential concept here, which comes out of Proverbs 31, has to do with the virtue of womanhood. Who can find a virtuous woman is the leading question. And from there, we have been opening up the issue of the meaning of womanhood, but inevitably or irrevocably, the idea of womanhood involves us in the idea of personhood, peoplehood. What is a person? I think if you start there and get your perspective on persons in general, as the Bible sees them, then you can move out to the issue of the difference between the genders, discussion of gender gap and so forth. But you have to start with the value of persons. I don't think one who has not a real sensitivity to the meaning of persons is not going to have a proper attitude toward womanhood or manhood either. I think you have to start deeper. And the battle rages in the media and the magazines and over TV, columns in the newspaper and so forth. You have great discussions or extensive discussions on the difference, and yet I get the feeling as I hear people addressing one another on the subject that the root problem is going back to the value and meaning of persons. Where people are out there clawing and scrapping and pushing to get their way, you know, they're not really interested in truth. That's really the qualification for even discussing the subject. If one is not interested in truth, if one is just trying to prove their point, there's no use even talking to them. Remember an article I read on the brain where a lot of new research had been done in terms of differences between the male and female brain function, and different hemispheres of the brain had varied usages within the male and the female. And it was research done by a research psychologist who was a woman. And someone attacked the article, not because it wasn't true, but because it set the cause of womanhood back. She should never have come out with that data because that was negative against the cause of womanhood or the now movement or whatever, woman lib. You know, when you have an attitude like that, there's no use even talking about it. I've had discussions with women in the matter wherein I've tried very much to relate to the problem. And, you know, I try to say, well, it's obvious that a lot of men simply don't know how to care for a woman as a wife and so forth. Every statement I made got challenged. What do you mean, care for a wife? What do you think, she has to take care of her? Just every statement, I try to explain. Nothing would satisfy. I've had the same experience talking to racial minorities. No matter what you say, they're going to challenge it. Well, you see, that reflects one basic point, that they haven't started from the right point. It isn't that they have to agree with me. It is only that they have to be willing to be open in the discussion. Within the church, you have a battle raging also on the subject, and people on both sides of the fence. Sometimes women clawing for a way, for a place at the top. Men, on the other hand, pressing the point to keep them away from places at the top and so forth. And once again, you come to the simple conclusion that they're not really interested in the truth. They just want to prove their point. I think that's an essential factor. And it's essential in the debate that's been raging between the candidates. And the obvious point is, truth is not a very popular commodity. I would never have agreed to debates if I were the incumbent, because debates are trickery. There's too much trickery with it. Too much opportunity to distort the truth, the facts, on both the part of the media and the opponents. I spent enough years in debate, traveled around in college teams and so forth, and I understand debate. I've used a lot of the trickery myself, not to, you know, proudly. I just you want to win a debate. And for us, the issue is winning the debate, not getting to the truth. And that's the issue in these campaigns. It has nothing to do with truth. How can we win the debate? And that's why in this whole subject of the place of womanhood, as spoken of by Solomon, or by in a proverb, is a pointless debate unless the people that are discussing it have a primary concern to know what God thinks about it, what the Word has to say, and what the truth is about the matter. And the truth is almost always somewhere between the opposites. Someone has said that truth is the harmonization of seeming opposites. Now, on the issue of womanhood, it's an issue that is important to everyone, not just to the women, not just to married people, and not just for the sake of womanhood per se, but for the sake of sensitivity to what God has made in the world and what He plans to do with what He has made. But you start at the point that we are beings created by God. As such, we embody, as created by God, characteristics of both sexes. And that's a good place to begin, too, because the male produces both androgen and estrogen, and the female produces both androgen and estrogen. Androgen is the male hormone, and estrogen is the female hormone. The levels differ and with individuals, and sometimes higher levels of androgen that are produced by a woman and higher levels of estrogens produced by some males more than average male. But I have to say this, I'm getting a little bit technical here, but it's, as I say, it's deeper than just the idea of what is the place of womanhood. It's first paving the way by getting a sensitivity to what is personhood. What does it mean to relate to people? And this is biblically oriented because it begins with the concept that God made male and female, and that He made first the male who was co-personal and divided the male and produced two persons out of the one, so that He separated the co-personal being and gave them different roles. So in the beginning, with the co-personal quality, male and female with a male, He would have produced androgen and estrogen in balanced quantities, perhaps. But when the separation took place and God removed the rib, now the word rib in Hebrew may not be as precise as we think of it. We're talking about the segment of the, probably a glandular segment, you see. So that one of the points is that whereas God is also co-personal. There's a great debate that rages, is God a male or a female? He's neither. He's co-personal. That is, that He has the quality within His spirit of both, in as much as the being was created in His image. But we are, in the human, we're looking at secondary sex characteristics, which to differentiate between male and female on the surface. And incidentally, the difference, there are different levels of estrogen and androgen produced by individuals. In other words, everyone has their own pattern here or a level of that hormone, of those hormones within them. But one thing I want to make very clear here, since again the battle rages over the issues of the homosexuality and so forth, I want to make this point very clear that the levels of estrogen and androgen only determine secondary sex characteristics and not so much the psychological factor. That is to say, if a male may produce an extraordinary level of estrogen, there may be a much lighter development of hair, for example. See, maybe a different pitch in the voice. Sort of. But that has nothing to do with the other matter, you see, of femininity. It has nothing to do with that, just with secondary sex characteristics. So the person who's trying to make a case for the fact that they are genetically oriented toward this thing, you see, you know, weep for us because we are weird. They have chosen that, and I have dealt in counseling with this problem considerably. And I have cases of different ones that have started on one end of the pole, that is, of being negative toward any kind of homosexual attitudes, and turning and becoming positive in practice, in activities that engaged in, you see. So to say we have to have a separate church, and we have to have a separate country, and we have to have a separate city, and to say we have to have special treatment from the government because we're physiologically oriented to this, and we can't help it, is not true. And a major medical opinion would go along with that. I mean, a lot of research is being done today, and a lot of people like to go the other route so that they can excuse their activity and say, we have a right to be all of these things. I bring that up only in the factor that there is the hormone production that is crucial to the issue that we're talking about. Not that it makes one person more prone to homosexual activity, but that it might have other psychological effects upon the individual, simply in terms of one might be more, perhaps more sensitive to the needs and attitudes and psyche of womanhood with different levels. But basically what I'm saying is that God has made a difference here, and that since the dividing of Adam, there is a major difference in the hormone production of the female and the male. Basically, estrogens are produced by the gonads. These are endocrine glands, which have to do with reproduction. The issue in the menopause is that the source of estrogen begins to diminish, but the adrenal gland produces both androgen and estrogen, so that in the female where menopause is taking place, there's still the production of estrogen in the adrenal gland, although there may need to be a supplemental hormone treatment that is through medication of one kind or another, or supplements, not medication per se, but hormones, either by injection or by oral tablets. As one gets older, theoretically, as society was originally intended, the activity decreases, and there's not as much need for the estrogen. But in our society, it doesn't work that way, and longevity has had a part here, and the shift in society so that today the middle-aged woman or the woman in the 50s or 60s may be very, very active in society, and therefore more demands upon them than might have been in the old days, where as the woman got older, the younger women took over the duties of the social unit or whatever it was. Now, why do I even bring that up? I'll tell you why. Because we need all of us to be very, very sensitive to the differences between one and another not so much in group terms to say we treat women differently than men, but in terms of every individual. There is so much related to the biochemical pattern. I've talked to you about this before, where you have the body has essentially about 31 different chemicals. Theoretically, they all ought to be in exact balance. And if you were to diagram it, you have spokes of a wheel. And there are different chemicals that make up the body, some having to do with ductless glands, the secretions, and some with the duct glands. And we have many different chemicals. Chemicals have to do with digestion, chemicals in the saliva, and so forth. So we have different chemicals. Now, I've said to you over and over again that a person's behavior patterns are often tied very closely to their biochemical pattern. That doesn't mean to excuse unsound behavior, but it just means to look at one another with sensitivity. Instead of scrapping over who's supposed to do what, recognize and sense the differences of people's needs. I have no doubt that biologically and chemically and so forth, for many reasons, there are women, for example, that have quite a capacity to function within what might normally be the male role. I have to remind you that history is filled with women that had very, very prominent places in leadership, very successful places. Golda Meir, for example, comes to mind. And in the Christian circles, someone like Corrie ten Boom. I've sat down and talked. Now, Corrie ten Boom is a fairly prominent person. She's written some books relative to the days of Nazi Germany and the concentration camps and so forth and her family's involvement. But she's a woman of great, became perhaps through all of her experiences, a woman of great substance. And I've talked to her privately, that is in person-to-person discussions, and one is not conscious one way or the other of the gender factor. You don't even think of that. I'm sure that would be true with someone like Golda Meir, probably true with someone in our modern contemporary society like Jean Kirkpatrick, who's a representative of the United Nations. Again, whether you agree or disagree with what she does or says or attitudes, that's not the point here tonight. It is that she is a woman that has great stature and might not be all of that far removed from the potentials of the vice presidency or perhaps the presidency. It may be far, it might be far better choice than some that have been looked at for the job. But I'm just calling to your mind, and you have a woman like Queen Victoria, the great dowager of England, who had a whole era named after her, the Victorian era, which for better or for worse was a very dynamic era in British history. That is not to make a positive statement about precisely what the role of women ought to be, but it is to soften our thinking in the sense that we don't nail down in some kind of humanistic tradition the bounds and limits. That you have to understand that there are general principles laid out in the scripture, and this is true of almost any kind of situation, but there are also exceptions. Whereas, for example, in the traditional society of the Old Testament, women did have primarily a place in the home and domestic activities and so forth, and yet you have someone like Deborah coming forth to become quite a leader in Israel as one of the so-called judges, very prominent in the book of Judges. In the New Testament era, you have people like Priscilla, the wife of Aquila, and who apparently had a very strong influence in the life of people there in the early church. Aquila and Priscilla had a church in their home. The indication is that Priscilla herself did a lot to open up the understanding of Apollos, who was one of the prominent early spokesmen for the gospel, for the word, one of the teachers. He was a teacher, basically. But when he met Priscilla and Aquila, he was limited in his understanding of the faith, so he had to be taken aside, and they had to explain to him the ways of the new church more perfectly. Well, that's a task that Priscilla apparently had a good hand in. So, without now opening all the doors to whatever one wants to do. I'm just saying that in God's mind, things do not flow as neatly as they do in our own minds. And we like to nail down very rigid structures and patterns. And we have to be careful about that sort of thing. So that's why, again, in the beginning here, to find some footing, I say let's start not with what are the gender roles. Let's start with what is the person role. What are we as persons to one another? If a man is sensitive to others, generally, men or women, you care about people, you care about their feelings, you're not judgmental, you're not impersonal, perhaps I should say, you have a care for people. Well, if you have a care for people, that's half the battle. Then you're going to look at any person in terms not of what you think, but what does God think about this whole thing? And that gives you an open heart, an open mind on the whole matter. And that's what would make a conversation like this profitable. People might say, well, why are you taking all this time to talk about womanhood? How about manhood? Well, we have to look at the whole picture. We have to start at the point of whether or not one really wants to know what God thinks, or one simply wants to defend one's rights or one's position. But that would be true of any argument you're ever in, any debate you're ever in. The question is, where is the other person really coming from? So often husbands and wives, for example, have a knockdown, drag-out fight because they have failed to recognize where the other person is coming from. You understand that people think on different frequencies. It's very often true between men and women that women tend to think and have a slightly different approach to things than men. Not absolute, but it's a generalization. Men talking to men can be on different frequencies. They're coming from a different point of view, and it's important to try to find out where the other person is really coming from, and most importantly, to see the other person in the eyes of Christ. What does Christ think of this person? And again, along with that, a person has to ask, what do I think of Christ? So, for example, the woman that is simply arguing for the rights of womanhood and is not really stopping to ask, what does Christ want here? Is not going to find satisfaction or truth. That has to do with the whole issue of whether a woman ought to work or not. And in part, it has to do with what the requirements of the home are. I think to bring children into the world and run off and leave them to somebody else to take care of is a questionable thing. There may be some extenuating circumstances where that's necessary, but what about the poor child? If a person does not want to spend time in a home, then perhaps they shouldn't have the children. The question is not one I can answer. The question that one has to answer for themselves, not what is my right. The question is always, what does God want here? Some children might survive in that kind of situation of getting into, being put out to pasture more or less. Others wouldn't. God knows that. Now, forever, our problems with one another, the continuing tendency to want to do what we want. Now, you can live at that level and still remain a Christian. That's not going to determine your salvation. But people make many decisions not at all based on what does Christ have for my life, but based upon A, what do I want? B, what does everybody else think? Of course, here's where the women get in trouble all the time because you've got everybody around giving advice, mostly amateurs. Mostly insensitive to the spiritual factor. And all these women's magazines and TV programs and so forth. The absence of any real sense of the Spirit is obvious. There's a certain female psychologist who is popular in the media. that has said such absolutely dumb things. I can't imagine that she can be a psychologist, period. Because a psychologist ought to be a lot more sensitive to the varieties of psyche, you see, and to the requirements of the individual. And I think to myself, this person has no roots at all in the spiritual factor to say what is a human being. It's only a question of how can we promote women's rights. You girls that are Christian girls, there should be no real problem with whether or not to listen to a person like that. I've had that question come up, and I've been almost startled by it. Well, there's so many different voices. How can you tell who to believe? Very simple. You better put the criterion of the Spirit on it. Because to say that you can fashion a life with human rationale apart from the Spirit is idiotic. You can do it just purely on human rationale. But if your life falls apart, don't blame Christ for it. Well, that's the question. I don't think there's any real arguments needed in the matter if the primary issue is what does Christ want? But of course, that's true in so many areas of life. And young people who are making decisions now, especially young people in the decision-making process of careers and home situations, marriage, all these things, these young people can be so misguided by secularistic counseling, misguided by amateurs at your elbow who always have a better way to do things. If you are comfortable with what you believe the Lord wants you to do, don't listen to anyone unless you can really know that they're coming from Christ and that they are praying for you and that they have savvy about these matters. Don't listen to the guys at work. Don't listen to media moguls. Don't listen to anybody. Because unless a person is coming from the Spirit, they're as liable to be as far off as the moon. They may be marvelous people, they may be successful people in their own right, in their own work. If they're not coming from Christ, forget it. Don't try to pick through the rubbish of humanistic thinking and find good things. Because if their good things have been in there, they're tainted. Because you've got to have the key point of the Spirit. Does that mean there's nothing in secular wisdom that has any value? It has value per se, but not to guide you unless it has the Spirit within it. I've heard this debate ever since I've been in the church, over and over again, Christian people saying, well, the Lord gave us a brain to use, etc., etc. I'm not so sure the gift has not been greatly limited. But yes, he gave us a brain to use. But unless you're going to make your decision in the name of Christ, you're just chugging off on a wrong track, that's all. So whether it comes to the job you're taking or the lifestyle you've chosen, the marriage or non-marriage situation, the way you and your wife handle your lives together, all of these things have to be individually handled in the name of Christ. And if you're comfortable with what you're doing and what you're feeling, what you're thinking, you're comfortable with that, don't let anybody move you off the track. You'll hear people say, oh, well, why do you do that? I can get you a much better job over here. Or you can make twice as much money if you do this or do that. Don't listen to them. Unless the person is coming to you from Christ and they've been praying with you and for you in the matter, and you've shared it together, and you can receive it comfortably as something that Christ has sent to you. Now, many women have been totally upset because of these great pressures from external sources. Now, one of the things about the influence of the women's lib movement is that the women who tend to be the leaders of these movements, the women who tend toward leadership capacities, are the kind of people who are going to make a life for themselves in careers or wherever they go, because they are automatically or generally are leadership material. Now, they may have exciting lives and fulfilling lives in the secular sense because they're leading the movement. It's like the guy that writes a book on how to succeed. He makes his money on the book, not on his success prior to that. I'm saying that about these women in leadership. If they, if their leadership is so fulfilling to them, why do they have to become leaders of the movement and make money writing books and so forth? The point I'm making is the large majority of the women that get unseated from their homes because they start thinking about this. They think, yes, see, this is drudgery, it's routine, and so forth and so forth. And here's this marvelous person up there, and she's just so vivacious and dynamic, doing all these wonderful things. So she pries the woman loose from her home. And where does she wind up? Punching the keys of a typewriter, assembling electronic equipment, more drudgery out in the workforce than she ever had at home. You see that? Because maybe, whereas the women who are prying her loose might have developed exciting lives, they're dooming these women to neither fulfillment in home nor fulfillment in careers because a large majority of these people are not geared to leadership. And they're geared to jobs that are in the workplace. They're in assembly plants, machine shops, many different kinds of jobs that are not exciting jobs. They're good jobs. They make money, but they're not exciting. You have some guy that comes on and says, why do you do gardening? You can go out and sell computers. You say, well, nice idea, but you may not be a computer salesman type thing. People have their different capacities. Now, if you trust Christ with your life and you refer to Him, you ask His guidance, He'll get you slotted where you belong. And if you move in a different vein than that, because you look at somebody else and say, oh, they have an exciting life, I'd like to do that, or they're making more money. Of course, you always have the relatives that come in on that angle. My gosh, you're just making that much money. Yeah, you ought to be making twice that. Why do you stick with that? Why don't you go out and sell lots on the moon or something and really be exciting? Let's look at it in the other vein, in terms of your growth, your progress with Christ. You're comfortable with it. That is, you're going along, you're at peace, you're doing your job. And some religious nitwit comes along to try to get you stirred up, and you hear it on television, go out and do these great things and have miracles in your life and all this wonderful, wonderful stuff. And it gets you all off the track. And I just talked recently with a young woman that had gone to a conference, a women's conference that was sort of charismatic in orientation. And it got her all stirred up, and she was just in great confusion, and yet, up until that time, she was doing fine. Well, then after I had a chat with her and we got things straightened out, she had peace again, But one of the sad things in our society is that human beings are forever trying to straighten each other out, tell each other what to do. And yet, most of the people that are talking about these things are amateurs, or they're not coming from the Spirit. And that is, even in the church, of many people that are not coming from the Spirit when they may talk to you about various things. And that would be true of women who are within the range of the church fighting for a place in the religious hierarchy or whatever. And they're going about in the church trying to get women going for God and so forth. Leave these opportunists alone. Just forget it. If you are at peace with what you're doing, and you are satisfied with your life, with your spirit, you're at peace in your spirit. You may not be thrilled with what you're doing. It may not be exciting. Taking care of a family is not an exciting proposition. It is a challenging thing. I think that the greatest amount of training a woman might receive, let's say who's been through college, is not wasted when it comes to raising children. Whatever she's learned, in other words, she doesn't need to think in terms of, I went all through college, now I'm settled down with a home and children, and I'm not being fulfilled. I'm saying to you, if you raise those children right, it requires the best that you have and all that you know. It's like in ministering as I am as a shepherd to you people here. And a great many years in university training and teaching and all these things. Not anything that I've ever learned have I considered wasted in terms of what it takes to deal with the multitude of human problems and complexities. And that's true with a woman raising children in a home. Now we're not talking about women's rights. We're talking about realities here. I've used the analogy of Michelangelo lying up there on the scaffolding painting his figures on the Sistine Chapel ceiling. And someone comes along to Michelangelo and says, "Hey, what are you doing that for? You're going to make a lot more money painting houses, you know." And so he throws down his brushes. He's going to fulfill himself. He's going to go paint houses, you see. Now, raising children is a highly creative task and calls for the best that's in you and is a noble task, just that it's far more noble for Michelangelo to paint the figures on the Sistine Chapel than for him to paint houses. A woman who leaves the children so she can go out and pound a typewriter or assemble electronic equipment or whatever, all of those things, to leave children so she can do that would be like Michelangelo leaving his artwork to go and paint houses. You know, these are very straight things I'm saying to you, but in the main, the women's rights movement today is sparked by secularistic motives. The woman who is committed to Christ is not going to talk about rights. She's going to talk about, what does Christ want from me? If he's giving you a home and family to take care of, and that's where you're comfortable, stay with it. If you get pried out into the marketplace when that's not where the Lord wants you, all it can do is breed destruction in your home. Now, there happen to be couples who either can't have children or for one reason or another don't have children. The woman is in some career. I understand that. I don't make any rigid demarcations here. Say no woman should ever be in careers. And in the realities of situations today, it's very difficult for a woman to find a man who is really substantial, who has his eyes fixed on Christ and has his goals right and so forth. It's hard to find. And a lot of guys are just opportunists, and the girl goes on a date with him and he just wants what he wants. He's not interested in her as a person. And it's difficult. So I have to allow a lot of room for girls who aren't married, may not be married. I can't guarantee that every woman in the church is going to get married. In the old society, it was almost a fixed thing. So a lot of these earlier societies, farm communities and so forth, they pretty well evened out. Somewhere down the line, a girl would get married, and that would be expected. But it just isn't that way today. A lot of times, a woman has lost a husband in a war, and she just had to go out and make a living. See, well, I'm very sensitive to that thing. So you have to look at each case not on the basis of what are women's rights. Forget the word. Kick it out the door. You don't need it. What does God want? He doesn't worry about rights. If you're worried about rights, don't get married. You'll lose them all at the altar. You can kill a marriage faster with rights than you can with wrongs, I have to say. People will forgive you your wrongs, but they'll never forgive you your rights. Don't worry about that, and don't worry about what other women are saying or not saying. Bellicose, strident. You hear a lot of these women screaming about their rights and everything, and they're harsh, and you don't like them very much as persons. You may have to agree with their political, you know, they may say things that might be valid in terms of women being treated in the marketplace. If women are accepted in the marketplace, there is a need to treat them fairly. That's not something you people have to worry about. What you have to be concerned about is a sensitivity what Christ wants. And that's true of you, of husbands and wives, in terms of the husband having to be sensitive to what Christ wants. He has to be sensitive to the needs of his wife. Not what do I get out of this thing, but what can I give to it? What can I bring to her? What can I do for her to help her, to minister to her needs? On that kind of an approach, We don't get into any big arguments over the details and trivia because this takes precedence over human rationale. What does Christ want?